due to switches now.
Love Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals the hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I'm just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Good evening and happy Shabbat to one and all. You know, we all have highs and lows in our lives, and there's times when we're jubilant and times when we're sad. I'm coming to you this evening at a very high point, and that decided that a friend of mine who is also a covenant, and I invited a non-covenant member over for dinner this evening. We do this on a regular basis. People we meet will invite them over for dinner, and we engaged in conversation. We actually concluded Pesach Matzah and Bukkotim by re-celebrating Pesach. It was good for Hezekiah. I guess it's and Yahweh approved. It's good for us. So we had lamb and we had the matzah and. I had olive oil with bitter herbs and the red wine, and had a lovely dinner this evening, and a celebration of the conclusion of Pesach Matzah and Bukkotim. It's also interesting that in the last 3 or 4 days, I've spoken very highly of my friend Jerry McLaughlin, who is probably the foremost publicist in the world when it comes to booking guests on TV and radio talk shows as expert witnesses. And he decided that based upon what happened in Sri Lanka, where 800 people were mutilated and over 200 people were dead, killed by Islamic fundamentalists, that somebody should confront the world and tell the truth. And I did these seminary interviews over these last few days, and I have found something that I had sensed, but was not, I didn't want to have to deal with it. The world has fundamentally changed since I initially wrote Prophet of Doom. When I originally wrote Prophet of Doom and Tea with Jairus, I did a little over 5,000 radio interviews as an expert witness on other people's shows. And it wasn't until the last two programs that I ran into people that use the lame, numbskull approach. Well, I know a Muslim, and they're not a bad person, so I'm going to throw out everything that you say. You know, 5,000 interviews, and it wasn't until the last two that I confronted people with that kind of lack of thinking, or that would play devil's advocate all the way through. And yet, that's almost all that I experienced this time through. The world has fundamentally changed for the worse. It's now extraordinarily rare to find someone who hasn't been influenced by political correctness. They've been told so many times and so vociferously that Islam means peace, that jihad is a spiritual struggle, that the Muslims who commit terrorist acts have perverted their religion. They've heard that so many times that they believe it. And to present the truth is now even more foreign to their ear than it was 10 to 12, 15 years ago. Every time that I would do it, I was just so glad that I'm not doing it anymore, or very seldom doing it. So it was a real interesting experience over these last few days. And the last thing I want to share is that I spoke at length a week ago about what I was currently translating and writing, and it's about Moab. What kind of idiot is going to get excited? Who even knows where Moab was? Who's ever heard of Moab? I mean, but Moab is a place in Utah, right? I mean, come on, guys. Had you ever heard of Moab?
Well, only from reading.
Only from translating by receipts, but
yeah.
I gave it much thought.
Yeah, and Moab is barely mentioned in Bereshit. Moab is the end of the story, the second to the last line of the story about Sodom, mentions Moab. Moab was the son of Lot through his eldest daughter. Ben Ami was the son of Lot through his youngest daughter.
Yeah.
And so, other than that, the name doesn't appear. And it was a nothing kingdom. I mean, the kingdom was, you know, the size of a postage stamp. Never amounted to anything. So how in the world, and the chapter now on Moab is 140 pages. So how in the world could you get so excited about Moab? I know, a kingdom, then you're writing prophetic, you're translating prophetic testimony, Yahshua, 15 and 16. And Moab ceased to exist in 50 BCE. But I want to tell you, the insights, the message that Yahweh took the time to tell, to weave into these stories for us to find, is so exhilarating, it's so enlightening, it's so empowering, it's so instructive, that it's almost like I was when I first realized that Paul was a false prophet and that the Moed Mikre were valid, and the covenant had terms and conditions. Your first response is, be mad. You know, why is it that all of these scholars, and not a single one of them, has brought this up? I mean, if I were to tell you, tell me what's the importance, what's the single most important part of the account of Sodom and why God destroyed them? What do you think 99.99% of people would say?
Oh, what they will say? They'll say sex and perversion.
Homosexuality.
Yeah, sexual perversion, right. Sexual perversion. And Christians will go one step further. They'll say homosexuality. Right? And sexual perversion. There's not a single homosexual reference in the whole story. The story doesn't even speak of sex until Lot and his daughters are long out of Sodom and Sodom's destroyed. And the first reference to sex is his daughters getting Lot drunk and having sex with him. Not in Sodom. Who references sex in Sodom? And so it's just, we want to scream that we have been so misled. Because, in essence, Sodom is us. Sodom is today. And it's not because of homosexuality, it's not because of sex. It's because of our errant thinking, our inability to think, our animosity towards God and His message. And so you read this and you say, oh my goodness, this has been there for us to understand, and this is how we've trivialized it. So, you know, the first response is to get mad, and the second response is to be inspired. And the third is that it's been both the most uplifting and debilitating experience, because when you view these things from Yah's perspective, you just want to sit down and cry. You know, I'm exhilarated that we're finding truths that affirm really important aspects of Yahweh's nature and plan. It's exhilarating. And then it's debilitating when you realize just how much of a mess we've made of things. So anyway, that's the story of the last week, and I understand that Kirk, you're blind as a bat, and your wife is sicker than a dog.
Yes.
That's basically the situation there. And Jackie, who is our foremost editor, has got sore and dry eyes that they're doing everything they can to try to resolve. And JB, what's your issue?
I'm doing good.
That's good. Okay. So you and I are both doing good. All right. Well, I would love to jump into the Moab story because it is it's one of the most powerful experiences, enlightening, uplifting experiences I've ever gone through. I want to jump back and let's finish the chapter on that began with the obliteration of Syria as a nation and with Damascus becoming a twisted heap of ruins and then Israel being pinned at the waist, the harvest of saved souls occurring thereafter, followed by an influx of Muslims armed to the teeth, screaming Allahu Akbar, coming into Israel to wipe Jews out to the last. Let's finish our recap of that. We were, I think in our last program, we were at Yashiyah 17:12. So let me read it and we can comment on it. It says, "Woe, be wary of the preponderance of the people of a great many nations, of those related by race, religion, and culture with followers, who will roar in hordes of agitated and confused terrorists, and vast multitudes of belligerent and loud-mouthed militants, flaunting their abundant wealth while clamoring emotionally with their worldly possessions and disorderly riots, agitated and enraged, with the masses congregating along with their troops for military purposes, and a disturbing matter, similar to the loud groaning of stormy and confused, surging and chaotic seas of Gentiles, who will choose to be driven by the winds of religious, political, and social desire." It's hard not to see that happening. We see it happen now around the world. The Christians throughout Syria and Iraq have rallied around their faith. Sunni Muslims, Shia Muslims, rallied around theirs. And Sri Lanka here recently, the Buddhists have finally taken to standing up to and opposing Islam. I think the way they're doing it is wrong. But nonetheless, they're doing it. And so we're witnessing this now. But God says it's going to become the preponderance of people, which means that the largest religions of the world, socialist, secular, humanism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and even in Hinduism, you know, it's a pacifist religion, as is Buddhism. It takes a lot to get under a Hindu or Buddhist skin, and yet now both are standing up to and opposing Islam. And according to God, it's going to get worse. And I can't see any scenario where this won't happen, where people are going to be driven by the winds of religious, political, and social desire. Now, I set out in a peninsula in the intercoastal of Fort Lauderdale and overlook a place that's called the Sandbar. And it's amazing the number of people that come with flags bigger than their boats and flying Trump, you know, MAGA, Make America Great Again flags. And if I drive one block in either direction, I'm surrounded by the Rainbow Coalition of Gay Pride, of people promoting their religious zeal. And it's going to become worse. Then it says, "And then the corrupting roar of the destructive societal chaos, the loud mocking cry of as things crash down in ruins around the huge presumptuous crowds of rebellious and confused militant terrorists who are panicked into fighting while wallowing in their depressed slime pits amidst the wasteful desolation associated with Sheol. The antiquated people of these nations who are transformed while congregating under the inspiration of a religious and a political leader will be like the destructive and desolating uproar of a corrupting flood, of those destined to the pit of Sheol, the dark and massive black hole, which traps all light entering it, forcefully in great numbers, seeking fame and fortune, wickedly intertwined and thought to be extraordinarily powerful, with grating passion, capitulating to the will of another. They will continually strive to destroy, moving rapidly, while ruining everything they touch, devastating themselves in the process, leaving lifelessness in their wake, such that it's prudent to watch them very closely for a duration of time. My dinner guest this evening was from Australia, and he clearly understood the threat of Islam. And what I shared with him, because he's listened to a number of Islamic experts say that that in a matter of 20 years, 30 years or so, it'll be all over, that Islam will control the world. I said, no, that's just not true. Islam has no hope of controlling the world. It can't win this war versus or any war. That all Islam is capable of is of destroying and killing. They're not capable of managing or building or creating. Islam, Muhammad, gave Muslims a reason to die, but not one to live. And so it is true that Muslims will continue to chip away at the world and will continue to destroy, just as they have done throughout Syria and Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq, the Sudan, Somalia. And they will continue to destroy, but they will never prevail.
What was your reaction? What was his reaction to what you said?
Total agreement.
Okay.
He was well versed on the subject.
Good.
Yeah, total agreement. And more and more people today are unlike their radio host that I did an interview with today that could never get out of devil's advocate mode. You know, as I would explain that, you know, Islam is a terrorist manifesto, and he'd say, well, you know, there's calls for killing in the Bible. You know, if you look at the Crusaders, they were vicious. I said, well, there's a profound difference. Christianity was, apart from Paul at least, was born peaceful. And it's only an aberration of some of the followers over time that have been vicious. I'll give you credit that the conquistadors, for example, who annihilated the Americas, they were vicious. But the religion wasn't born that way. Islam was born that way. Muhammad was a terrorist. He was a mass murderer. The fundamental difference. It says, well, you know, in Bible times and in ancient civilizations, people got married earlier. So, you know, to call Muhammad a pedophile is unfair. I said, no, you're wrong. You're just absolutely wrong. Yeah. In ancient times, 15-year-olds married 15-year-olds. And 20-year-olds married 20-year-olds. But it has never been acceptable for a 50-year-old to have sex with a 6-year-old. Ever. And I said, Muhammad was a rapist. He said, well, you know, if you look at the Japanese in World War II or the Russians in World War II, they raped everyone in sight. Yes, they did. And we should condemn them for doing so. But here's how Muhammad went about rape. You know, he would go into a town, an agricultural town. He would kill the men, enslave the children, and then play a game of lots to determine who got to rape which woman. So if we're willing to condemn the Japanese for what they did in Nanking and in the Koreas with their comfort women, and they were just living out their politics, ought we not also condemn, and even more vociferously, someone who claims to be speaking for God, who establishes a religion that 1.5 billion people follow, that was engaged in this? Oh, there it is, right in front of me. That goddamn boat that's got an American flag that's got to be 6 feet by 10 feet and two Trump MAGA flags along with it. You know, I don't care that you think that Trump is the greatest thing since sliced bread. I don't care that you are too stupid for words. Don't care. Don't care that you're political. Don't care that you're so ignorant of America. You think that what we did in Iraq and Afghanistan and Vietnam was productive. that you think that $20 trillion in debt is a sign of economic prosperity. I don't care. But when you have to put it on your boat and rub it in other people's faces, then it's irritating. So here we are with God explaining what we're going to witness in our future. You know, we have been confronted with the first of two woes, warnings, that Yahweh has integrated into this dire prophecy. A great many nations will dispatch a veritable sea of Islamic jihadists. Now, I suspect the number is going to be over 100 million mujahideen that will emerge from the 50 fiefdoms which comprise a Muslim majority. Now, these places, the places where Muslims comprise a majority and that collectively will provide probably 100 million mujahideen, are Afghanistan, 99.8% Muslim, 20 million Islamic population, Albania, 82% Muslim, Algeria, 98% Muslim, but 35 million, I should say, Muslims, 98%. I mean, these countries, can you imagine a country that's that percentage, one religion?
No.
It just speaks volume of it. Azerbaijan, 98% Muslim. Bahrain, 81% Muslim. Bangladesh, 90% Muslim. The rest is Hindu, of course. Brunei, 52%. Burkina Faso, 59%. Chad, 56%. Comoros, 98%. Egypt, 95%. 80 million Muslims. Gambia, 95%. Guinea, 84%. Indonesia, 88%. Iran, 99.7%, with 75 million Muslims. Iraq, 99% Islamic, 31 million Muslims. Jordan, 98.8%. Kazakhstan, 56%. Kosovo, 92%. Kuwait, 86%. Kyrgyzstan, 89%. Lebanon, 60%. Libya, 97%. Malaysia, 61%. Maldives, 98%. Mali, 92%. Mauritania, 99%. Morocco, 99.9%. 32 million Muslims. Niger, 98%. 16 million Muslims. Nigeria, 50%. Oman, 88%. Pakistan, 96%. 178 million Muslims. The Mithatanian Authority, the Palestinians, 96% Muslims, 12.3 million. Sierra Leone, 72%. Somalia, 98.6%. Senegal, 96%. Sierra Leone, 72%. Somalia, 99%. Sudan, 71%. Syria, 93%. Tajikistan, 99%. Tunisia, 99.8%. Turkey, 98.6%. Turkmenistan, 93%. United Arab Emirates, 76%. Uzbekistan, 97%. Western Sahara, 99.6%. Yemen, 99%, 24 million. In the Islamic country, where there is no public discourse other than Islam, and where the only Islamic discourse is fundamentalist, to not be a jihadist is a death sentence. And in those countries, the majority of young men, and even a significant number of young women, are going to sign up to be jihadists. I mean, the average age of the rapidly rising Islamic population of 1.275 million in these 50 countries that have a Islamic majority is 22. That's the average age. With more than two-thirds of fighting age, which would be between 15 and 50, since 90% of the jihadists are male, and since 70 to 80% of Muslims are fundamentalists in places like this, and thus predisposed religiously to be mujahideen, if only one in three of those who are eligible to fight are motivated by their clerics, political potentates, the media, their peers to do so, these nations alone will dispatch an estimated 130 million fighters in all its costs. Those are the numbers. And those who might otherwise deter would be defined as hypocrites by the Quran's Nisra and would likely be killed by fellow Muslims as apostates. So it's possible that the Islamic countries could send 200 million individuals. But that would not be the end of the militants. The 30 nations where collectively another 285 million Muslims reside, which boasts a significant percentage of Allah devotees, will also send millions of mujahideen. These in places like Bosnia-Herzegovina, Bulgaria, Cameroon, Central African Republic, Cyprus, Ethiopia, France, Georgia, Ghana, Ghana, Israel, Ivory Coast, Kenya, Liberia, Macedonia, Malawi, Mozambique, Russia. 12% of Russians are Muslim, 16.4 million. Macedonia, 35%. Singapore, Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka at the time I wrote this was 9%, it's probably 10 now. Tanzania, 30%. Uganda, 12%. The percentage of Muslims in these countries who are religious fundamentalists and who will choose to fight will be considerably less because they, as a minority population, Islam cannot be imposed. Accurate information is available, thinking is somewhat encouraged, and life is worth living. Therefore, as few as 10% of the eligible jihadists may elect to bludgeon Jews. This would still yield another 10 million mujahideen. Also, based upon the description that Yahweh has provided with all Gentile nations participating, additional jihadists will flow out of nations with relatively small percentage of Muslims. The 33 un-Islamic countries from which mujahideen will emerge include Argentina, Australia, Austria, Belgium, Burma, Canada, China. You know, China is only 2% Islamic. And yet there's still 23 million Muslims. Congo. Yeah. Denmark. Yemen. Fiji. Germany. 5% at the time of this writing. 6 billion Muslims. Greece. 5%. Guyana. Italy. Mongolia. Nepal. The Netherlands. Norway. The Philippines. Serbia. Slovenia. South Africa. Spain. Sweden. Switzerland. Thailand. Trinidad. Ukraine, the United Kingdom, and finally, the United States. 1% Islamic, 2.9 million. Boy, I think of the 2.9 million Muslims in the United States, that between my last two homes in Cincinnati and here in South Florida, that we got the majority of them. And I know that if you live in Dearborn, Michigan, you would beg to differ. Mm-hmm. There are 55 million Muslims living in these overwhelmingly non-Islamic nations, since the voice of their clerics is substantially muted in these places, and since Muslims have very little influence in the government, military, and media, we should expect as few as 1 in 20 fundamentalist Muslim men between age just 15 and 50 to join the Great Jihad. Now, based upon this analysis, we should expect that the vast preponderance of jihadists, somewhere between 130 million and 200 million mujahideen, will come from the 50 nations with an Islamic majority. The 63 countries with a smaller Islamic percentage of Muslims may send as many as 10 million more jihadists. Now this veritable sea of religious rage is going to flood into Israel from all directions. Multitudes will approach via the Caspian, Black, Marmara seas. Others will sail across the Mediterranean. Many will transverse the Aegean. Armed hordes will roar across the Nile Delta and the Suez Canal. Some will circumnavigate the Arabian Peninsula via the Red Sea. Many more will flood into eastern Israel across the Jordan, the Dead Sea, and the Sea of Galilee. Like a swarm of locusts devouring everything in their path, screaming, Allahu Akbar, Allah is a mouse in the land of Yahweh. The death brigade will appear unstoppable. To be a Jew in Israel at this moment will be terrifying.
Hard to read it.
It's hard even to read it. Yahweh deployed Hamon in this context to convey that these hordes of agitated terrorists who are confused and loudmouthed will roar into Israel, flaunting the weapons they possess. It is an appropriate depiction of Islamic jihadists today. With anguished screams, snarling, and growling, they will bring their unique kama, societal chaos, to the one part of the Middle East that they have thus far been prevented from corrupting. Islamic jihadists will flood into Israel, eroding the promised land with each successive and relentless wave, and bear great numbers, and with great passion, they, Ya'ah, will lay waste. It'll be the greatest tsunami of terror the world has ever witnessed. That is our future. The people of these antiquated nations, it's really derived from Laom. Remember our investigation of Laom, antiquated nations who are congregating under the inspiration of a religious or political leader representing Babel. Those whose outdated faith has nonetheless transformed the masses, making them similar to widespread and horribly destructive floodwaters, which are devastating and desolating, captivating, or capitulating to the will of another. They will continually strive to lay waste, moving rapidly while creating an uproar, ruining everything they touch, destroying themselves in the process, leaving a wake of lifelessness and death. Such that it is prudent to watch them closely for a duration of time. Yeah, we'll repeat this. Why? Doesn't want us to miss it. Pay attention. I was doing a radio interview today, and there were just lots of places where this host was playing devil's advocate, and said, why are you doing this? Most people just want to go about their lives and live their lives. And what harm is it that they, you know, they have one belief system or another? Well, I said, I don't care what people believe, so long as they don't act upon it in a way that's devastating for others. And Muslims do. Yeah. So, well, why speak out? You're not going to change anybody's mind. I use this story that I've shared so many times. If you were an engineer and you investigated the cables underneath a bridge and a suspension roof, and you knew for a fact that they were going to fail, and that as soon as a lot of people were on that bridge, it would collapse and everybody on it would die, and you're standing at the emerging end of that bridge, are you going to tell the throng of people that they're wrong? That their faith in that bridge is misguided, that bridge is going to lead directly to their death, become attacked by them, unpopular by them? Are you going to have the courage and the compassion and the character to do that? Or are you just going to waltz off to their death? For that, he had no answer.
And say he had no answer. Was it brain dead?
No. Oh, that's where we are. You know, the people of these antiquated nations who are congregating under the inspiration of religious and political leader representing Babel, this outdated faith which has transformed the masses, making them similar to horribly destructive floodwaters. Are we just supposed to sit by and let this happen? It's going to happen. But if no one has the courage, the compassion, the character to warn people and leave them without excuse, then that's just not fair. It's not appropriate. What's appropriate is to warn people so that they can make an informed decision, those who are willing to do so. Then this goes on to say, but then he will rebuke them, issuing a warning against them while criticizing their corruption in an insulting manner, while angrily censuring them, so that they will be swiftly driven away, denied what they sought, and they shall disappear, going into a distant place of alienation. I was told in this interview, Kirk and JB, narrow-minded because there was only one perspective that I was willing to consider. And, well, yeah, actually, I'm willing to consider every perspective, particularly popular perspective, because I like to understand them so I can expose and condemn them, because until I do so, until somebody does so, most people aren't willing to entertain the truth. But having been given access to the perspective of the creator of the universe, of the author of life, why would I want to embrace any other perspective than his? What is the advantage once you know his perspective of taking another?
There is none.
This is what God's saying. This is God's approach is to expose and condemn, insulting, angrily censuring, criticizing these religious manifestations. If it's God's approach to do so, how can it be wrong for us to do it?
Have you or JB found a prophecy in all your studies so far that's been wrong?
No.
Case closed.
That was part of what I said on this show. I said, no, the difference is that Yahweh's got the only testimony that can be verified through prophecy. Thousands upon thousands of them recorded 2,000 and 3,000 years ago in writing that have materialized or on the cusp of materializing today. And so he proves his existence. And if he proves that he existed outside of the construct of constraints of time and therefore is God, ought we not listen to him?
Seems pertinent to me.
You know, if I've got a being that says, I created the universe and I am the reason for life, it's my conception, and I'm offering you a way to live with me forever and to be empowered and enriched by me, and these are the things you need to do, and this is what I will do for you in return, I'm all ears. I'm all eyes, I'm all ears. My mind is open. I want to know. And once I know, I don't want any other alternative in the way.
Total agreement.
It's fairly straightforward and simple. And they will be chased and driven away, hunted down and hounded, even harassed before they vanish, just as the chaff of the grain, which is discarded. And blown away in the hills before approaching the approaching presence of the Spirit. And like a rolling ball of dung, akin to a tumbleweed in a whirlwind, before the approaching presence of the storm, thereby fulfilling and completing that which has been promised in the end. Now, it's one thing for us to do as we should do, which is to expose and condemn doctrines that inspire pedophilia, rape, terror, and mass murder, and lead people away from God. But that's as far as we ought to go. And we should use Yahweh's words and evidence for reason to do so. But it's God's prerogative, and only his, to hunt them down, harass them, cause them to vanish. That's not our job. With that stupid idiot did in New Zealand was counterproductive.
Very much so.
There's no justification for it. The moment you pick up a weapon and start killing people, you're your own worst enemy. Don't do it. Use words. What did Yahweh use? Words.
Words.
You know, I've just recently translated the story of a king of Yehuda that saw fit to take a knife and slice up Yahweh's testimony and then burn it. Mm-hmm. And so Yahweh told Jeremiah, just grab another scroll. We'll just write it all down again. Now this notion that you can slice away at Yahweh's words or incinerate them as Christians have done with his Torah. Paul reason. And, you know, we just can't chip away at them and destroy the ones that we don't like. And now, there's a couple of statements here that really ought to get our attention. That God's going to chase the negativity of religion, and particularly Islam, out of the Promised Land. Because Israelis are not going to be able to defend themselves. It's just too big an onslaught. But what he said is that this will be, the Spirit will do this before the approaching presence of the storm, which is going to fulfill what has been promised in the end. Now, you've got a tsunami that includes over 100 million jihadists, which God himself has to intervene to save Israel. And that's the tempest before the storm? Can you imagine how bad the storm's going to be?
Hard to consider.
Now, this assault will be comprised of a Laoma multitude of antiquated people who have been changed by a compelling religious and or political leader. And there's no religion more antiquated than Islam. So I did a radio show on a Christian station where they were calling people to the Christianity of the first century. Didn't realize there was no Christianity in the first century, but nonetheless, that's what they're calling.
Yeah, that is it.
Yeah, be that as it may. They're going to come from Rabim Amim, a great many nations. It's going to be the most misguided force ever assembled by man. Muslims, moronically believing that Allah is God and that he wants them to kill Jews for him, will be confronted by Yahweh, who actually is God. And after rebuking those Muslims, thereby affirming that they are ignorant, irrational, and immoral, he's going to deploy his Spirit to blow them away in a fatal blow to Islamic aspirations. Now, on the positive side, the most deadly, destructive, and demonic plague the world has ever known will be eradicated. By saying that he's going to rebuke them, criticizing their corruption, God is shattering a common religious misconception. Muslims bristle and often strike when the religion is criticized. They, like most Christians, falsely believe that religion is godly, divinely inspired, and beyond reproach, even if the evidence wielded against their belief system is indisputable. Even if the citations brought to bear against their faith are derived exclusively from their most trusted scriptural sources, even if the rationale is irrefutable. The faithful universally slander the messenger as being disrespectful, hateful, and demonic. It's just astounding, the ad hominem arguments that the religious will use. And while it will be too late for these wannabe killers, Yahweh's rebuke will benefit others, those with an open mind, those who remain receptive to listening to what God has to say to these religious assailants may turn to Yahweh and his Torah for answers. Now, this scene is visibly and vividly described by Yahweh. The Muslims who have sought to kill his children and confiscate his land, Nuak, will retreat, taking flight as they're forced to flee for having men Mershak, having been in opposition to him. The jihadists will be pursued and driven away like motes, dead and discarded chaff. And while Yahweh will not be visible at this time, the approach of his spirit, Ruach, will be sufficient to cause the tanks and troop transports to appear like tumbleweeds. Bad news for Islam. Yeah, that's it's going to be quick and short and quick, unequivocal, powerful. That's why we read that the defensive fortifications of nations are going to be abandoned. This is not going to be lost on anyone. You know, there are 7 billion smartphones, all of which can record video and sound. There'll be lots of people recording this. It'll be broadcast around the world. And if you're sitting there on a, and you're locked in a tank and driving it someplace, you're in a PT boat, you're an infantryman. What are you going to do?
Say,
wait a minute. Every one of those weapons was blown away like they were a tumbleweed. I'm not going against it. I don't know what happened there, but I ain't going against it. Whatever weapon that one was, we got to get one of those, but since we don't have it, no, I'm not taking that on.
Get out of Dodge.
Yeah. They're just going to abandon Dodge.
You think Japan surrendered quick after the nuclear bomb.
And they didn't. I mean, they lollygagged around. They didn't want to surrender. They wanted to deny reality. But in this case, we're not talking about two cities.
No.
And we're not talking about something happening that they had to fly to these cities to see for themselves, and if they flew to them, they were irradiated. So this is an entirely situation. Our world has fundamentally changed. I mean, people are spending an average of 6 to 7 hours a day online, and 7 billion people have smartphones. None of this will be hidden. The entire world is going to know it instantaneously. Approaching the timing of the noxious religious disorder and mixing together of the Arab awakening and sunset, of the rising up of Arabians, the evening of foreigners, the night of religious upheaval when many intermingle and make a pledge to join in and participate in something entirely toxic and deadly. Then behold, look now and see here, terror. Enormously dreadful and fear-inducing terrorism. The shock and awe of calamitous destruction perpetrated on civilians by armed militants. Sudden and startling. Destructive. All by terrorists who have long enjoyed perpetuating heinous acts which result in the cessation of life in the name of Allah. Who would have thought that a world would ever reach that point? And that is where we are. Terror. Religious terror. The mixing together of the Arab awakening and sunset. You know, the whole concept of what happened in Libya and Syria and to some degree at Egypt, all blamed on the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. And God says, no, it's not an Arab Spring. It's an Arab awakening. It's the Arab sunset.
Yeah, it's the end of Arab.
And what it's going to produce is terror. Terror. She was right. The cessation of life in the name of Allah. In the time before the dawn, this large migration of asses who are religiously inspired to sacrifice their lives and those of others will be no more, and they will be gone and negated. They will be for naught because they will fail, ceasing to exist. Many of you have probably read the news where the two of the suicide bombers in Sri Lanka had the same father. You know, the old line that, you know, they're oppressed, they are denied economic opportunities, the liberal approach to everything, that people are justified in what they're doing because they were denied opportunity, the one percenters held them down, they couldn't get a good education, there's no opportunity for a good job, and therefore they naturally revolted, and this is what they chose to do to lash out.
Well, what about two of the suicide?
Yeah, two of the suicide bombers. Yeah, Osama bin Laden doesn't fit that very well, does he? Two of the suicide bombers. Daddy was a billionaire. And one of them is captured on a couple of minutes of video. Walking down the street, walking into a plaza, patting a little child on the head, shitting green on his face, walking into a church, and then blowing himself up, mutilating and killing over 100 people. He's rich. Son of a billionaire. Educated in the West. The cessation of life in the name of Allah.
Your heart's sick, don't it?
This is the fate of those deceived by seductive words, the consequence of their choices. It is what happens as a result of misleading and pervasive propaganda which promotes wrongdoing. The ruinous reward for those seeking territory based on lies. The devastating share of what is apportioned to those who have been seduced by sexually suggestive speech, errant opinions, and illegitimate praise, of marauders who plunder and pillage us, of the militants trying to ransack and rob us by force, and of the allotment and retribution, the payback, of those who seek to conquer us, carry off the spoils of war because they despise and disrespect us. Yashayah, Isaiah 17:14. For us not to identify that with Islam, deceived by seductive words, the result of what happens from misleading and pervasive propaganda, which promotes wrongdoing. The ruinous reward of those seeking territory based upon lies. The devastating shore that is a share that is apportioned to those who have been seduced sexually by multiple virgins. The errant opinions and illegitimate praise of the marauders who plunder and pillage us, Israel. Of the militants who ransack and rob us of Israel. Trying to carry off the spoils of war because they despise us. It's Muslims and their opposition to Islam. It is so obvious. And it was written, 2700 BCE. Islam wouldn't even exist until 700 CE. 14 centuries before Islam was conceived by Muhammad. Identifying the place it would happen, identifying the timing, the words that were used to describe it, the tactic that they would deploy, the reward they would contemplate, their argument, which was borders, all of it's there. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not Notre Dame. This is not something gray and questionable, and that it's only after the events you can say, well, maybe if we twist this and negate that, pull this out of the context, it could be referring to such, that, and the other. No. This is explicit. And it's exactly what we're witnessing. Islam has been so deceitful and destructive, so deadly and debilitating, indeed so overtly satanic. Yahweh devotes the closing paragraph to denounce their religion. During a period when ill-informed journalists are referring to the Holocaust of violence exploding around the Muslim world as the Arab Spring, Yahweh correctly identifies this time as the darkness of the Arab sunset. God even acknowledges the religion's signature act, Ma'Allah, terrorism in Allah's name. The deliberate and dreadful mauling and murder of civilians to promote a political and religious objective. Islam and terrorism are now indistinguishable, with fundamentalist Muslims committing over 99% of all terrorist acts worldwide. Just as been the 1,400-year history of Islam, Muslims will continue to destroy everything they touch, including themselves. Those have been deceived, devouring their religious propaganda, believing that their wannabe prophet and God were speaking truthfully in the Quran, particularly in their surah, the 8th surah, named the Spoils of War, that booty is lawful and good, will find themselves in exactly the opposite situation, that God's not going to allow them to take the booty. He's going to say, no, this is bad. Coveting plunder, they will discover that these things will cost them their souls. The would-be plunder, they will discover that these things will cost them everything. I was doing a radio interview this week in Chicago, and this host had a Muslim call in. And the Muslim began by saying, the one thing about Islam, we will never denigrate the prophet of any religion. I said, well, stop there. The Quran's presentation of the Hebrew prophets denigrates them. You know, you begin with Yahusha, the Christian Jesus, and you call him Esau, the person God called out to say he hates. And then the accounts of all of the others are so twisted and so perverted as to denigrate them in the book itself. And then not liking that answer, he said, you know, giving Jews Israel is like deciding tomorrow that we're going to give Jews Chicago. I said, well, I'll tell you what. On this point, I was just talking over him. That's the dumbest thing that I think I've ever heard. The correlation between giving a people their homeland back when it's demonstrably their homeland, and you compare that to a place like Chicago that isn't their homeland and has no association with them. It's just so moronic that you ought not be promoting such nonsense. It went on and on and on. It's just amazing how corrupt the thinking is of individuals and how they're just absolutely incapable of thinking. Confused. By Babel, of course. This phase of the Magog War is now over. Islam was defeated by Yahweh. Collateral storm is now on the horizon, and that should be of grave concern to the nation described in the 18th chapter of Yahshua America. The United States is depicted in very unflattering terms. And while they aren't explicitly told why America makes this its prophetic debut at this point, the transition from this chapter to the next is sufficiently indicting. In the context of the prophecy and current world history, we know the United States is the reason Damascus will be destroyed and Syria will fail. The proxy war has ravaged the region is a direct result of America's foolish and counterproductive of Iraq, in effect of giving Iraq to Iran. The influence of Iran and Shia Islam have surged, as a result threatening the surrounding Sunni fiefdoms. In response, the Sunnis have recruited Islamic jihadists and have transferred U.S. weapons to them, igniting the catastrophic proxy war in Syria. Ultimately, the Sunni Mujahideen will prevail. They outnumber the Shia 4-1. And the 46 majority Sunni nations outspend the 4 Shia countries 10-1. $155 billion in weapons to 15. But bring down the Assad regime, and you will exacerbate the world's problems, just as was the case of toppling the Taliban, Saddam Hussein, the Shah of Iran, and Muammar Gaddafi. The vicious Sunni jihadists will return to the nations from which they have come, and there will be a reign of terror that's going to commence around the world. The Mujahideen who remain in Syria will be unrestrained, turning a religious rage against Israel. And not only has the United States sold over $100 billion of their deadliest weapons to the Sunni Islamic countries that have supported the rebels, supplying 25 times more military hardware to Israel's foes than to the Israelis themselves, the U.S. has built entire armies for the Iraqis and Afghanis, the Egyptians and the Pakistanis. The flame of war has been kindled, and the United States has been caught supplying the fuel and holding the torch. If that were not enough to earn Yahweh's wrath at this critical junction in history, America has taken the lead in brokering an irrational peace treaty that will cost Israel dearly, forcing the nation to surrender the land to Muslims, which continue to seek the obliteration of the promised land. Seizing upon this ill-conceived opportunity while wielding weapons supplied by the United States, Islamic jihadists by the tens of millions, even over 100 million, will plunder Israel. And while they're going to fail, with Yahweh's spirit blowing them away, this is just the calm before the storm. One foretold told in the Song of the Sea, a story that we'll consider in the next chapter. And that brings us to the conclusion of this chapter, the second to the last in the second volume of Observations for Our Time. And so, gentlemen, we have a choice. We can turn back the page and tell the story of Moab, the story of Sodom and Lot, the story of Israel and its history with this people, and Yahweh's prophecies regarding Lot and Moab. Or we can go right now to the what Yahweh says about America, which is riveting, and it's timely. And it flows right out of what we have just read, with God specifically condemning the United States of America for aiding and abetting Israel's enemies. What would you prefer to do?
Heaven.
Pardon?
Moab. Lot.
Okay. What do you think,
JB, what do you think?
I mean, JB may have stepped away for a moment to take care of his daughter. Well, Moab, if it is Moab, we can turn to come out of her, my people, leaving America and the world, which is the call that Yahweh has made for his people. Maybe it is wise that we understand the world today as viewed through Moab. This is then chapter 11. It's called Where the Torah's Voice Died. Cleaning House. We have found so many of the answers that we initially sought, but there's so much to learn. Yahweh's revealed when, where, and how, and why the adversary has positioned himself as the Lord of Religion. We now understand how, when, and why the world has come to worship Satan as if he were God. He has also affirmed the consequences and the connections that exist between Satan and Babylon, between Ashur and the Queen of Heaven, the Mother of God, and especially between Shaul and Sheol, the plague of death that Pauline Christianity has become and the black hole which will incarcerate its proponents. Not surprisingly, each time Hillel ben Shakar has been exposed, Shaul has been right there with him, becoming more infamous than Hadrian, more infamous than the Kippa, Theodosius, or Muhammad. Now, while it's advantageous to know one's adversary, the primary purpose of all of these volumes has been and remains to provide the proper perspective for those seeking to engage in a relationship with Yahweh, especially as we approach his return. Now, to this end, we have discovered that there would be a sign that Yahweh will raise for the world to see, especially for the benefit of his people, Yisrael and Yehuda. Now, whether these words are on that banner or simply point to it, it's time to press forward in the realization that by concluding the second volume of Observations for Our Time with the 18th chapter of Yashaya, those who read on will know what to expect as time draws nigh. But more than this, with every word, the observant will find irrefutable affirmation that the prophetic testimony we are considering was inspired by none less than the Creator of the universe. Now, in the 18th chapter, which we're postponing for right now, of Observations for Our Time, which is the 18th chapter of Yeshayahu, the theme isn't so much to expose and condemn the United States, which it does, but to explain why it's important for Jews to flee. 42% of the Jewish population in the world lives in the United States. 42% lives in Israel. And God is saying to them, come out of her, my people. Come out of the United States. My people? Israel and Yehuda. All of this is written because Yahweh made a promise to Abraham that he would restore his relationship with the descendants of his grandson, Jacob. And he affirmed that commitment to Yishak and to Jacob and countless times thereafter. And so God has made this promise that he's going to honor it. And he's going to raise a sign that calls his people home, that says, come out of her, my people. And he's speaking of Yehuda and Yisrael as his people. And that place he's asking to come out of is not just Babylon, it's the United States of America. Now, it's amazing how much information Yahweh has already revealed about what's going to transpire politically, religiously, and militarily over the next decade. And now, by studying the continuing revelations found in Yahshiyah, our investigations will lead us to wondrous and alarming new discoveries. Now, as we travel back through the names of the ancient places throughout the Middle East that have once been inhabited, we're going to learn a great deal about those mankind calls home today. We began this, Kirk, with you and I before our program started recording, talking about we've always known that every Hebrew name conveys an important insight.
Yes.
And yet so few bother to translate them. I wonder why. We don't even transliterate most of them accurately in English Bibles.
Not even close, some of them.
I mean, one of the few that we actually transliterate with any degree of accuracy is Hasatan.
Well, I love that.
It's Hasatan in Hebrew, it's Satan in English.
Baal.
Baal. We will translate Baal as Lord.
But, I mean, it's transliterated when it's used as Baal, and they make sure they present his name properly.
Yeah. That's true. It's transliterated accurately as Baal. Yeah. That's absolutely true. So, why is it that the names of God, of his prophets, are never translated accurately?
Well, how about David?
David's not.
D-V-D,
there's no V in Hebrew.
No.
If there's no V in the language, how in the heck can his name be David?
Can't.
No. The name is three letters long. And I will grant you that vowels are sometimes supplied when there's not there. Even though there's five of the 22 letters of Hebrew are vowels, there is one vowel in and it sits between the two consonants, D-W-D. The wa is almost always an O, so dode is for certain.
Mm-hmm.
Could it be doid? And you'd add a supplied vowel before the second D? Yeah, I guess it's possible, but why do it if you've already got a vowel between the two consonants?
Mm-hmm.
So it's dode. Why did they screw it up? Because dode means something really special in Hebrew. Beloved. Why change Yehuda to Judah? Judah doesn't mean squat. Yehuda means beloved of Yah. Why did they do that?
A confusion?
Perhaps.
Babylon is Babylon. That's the deal.
Yeah. As we travel through these names, then, of the ancient places, it's possible to learn a great deal about the world today. In this way, Yahweh provides us with a linguistic treasure every time he walks us through the towns and villages of historic principalities, such as Moab. This tiny and long extinct kingdom was once wedged between the desolate mountains opposite Yehuda, on the eastern shore of the Dead Sea and the Arabian Desert, flanked by the Arnon and Zered rivers on its north and south. Moab's location seems to play an insignificant role, and the Tungla populated wilderness of roaming Bedouins, has the unique distinction of being featured in multiple prophecies which play out during the time of Jacob's troubles. It's in Daniel. It's featured as an entire chapter in Jeremiah. Moab comprises two entire chapters of Yeshayah. Why is that, do you suppose?
Well, I don't
In fact,
know why.
At the time the prophecies were written, guys, Moab had ceased to exist by anywhere from 100 to 150 years.
Okay.
Now, this realization becomes abundantly clear when we consider the fact that God's upcoming prophetic warning is set in the midst of end-time events as the other references to Moab and Yakazel, Ezekiel 25. Now, Moab's there again, in the midst of the Magog War. Daniel 11. Amos 2. Oh, my. Zephaniah 2. Boy, I tell you what, we're going to get to that in this chapter. That is a treasure. And Jeremiah 48, which we'll cover in this chapter. And then in the first volume third volume of Observations for a Time, that's going to be the second place we go. We're actually going to begin, Kirk, I was talking to you about this at the beginning of the program. In Zephaniah, Yahweh speaks of having told his people and warned them about a certain behavior that was going to lead to dire consequences. So, and they said, you didn't listen to me then. So I wonder why he did that. Do you know that Yahweh has a Sermon on the Mount?
I know.
You guys ever heard that? You heard about Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's Matthew 5, 6, and 7. It's his first public address, the largest public address he'd ever engage in. Right? You know that Yahweh has the Sermon on the Mount? Yeah, it comprises a better part of three chapters of the book of Kara. But the principal sermon, if you will, and I'm going to use, I know that's a terrible religious term, but I want the comparison to stick in people's mind that Yahweh has a Sermon on the Mount and nobody knows about it. That yes, Yahweh explains in Kara 23 the invitations to meet with him, to be called out. Lloyd McGrayer presented in their entirety in the 23rd chapter of Kara, are they not?
Mm-hmm.
24th chapter of Kara is interesting. Most people don't even know what's there. In fact, if I were to say, okay, what follows the Lloyd McGrayer in the book of Kara, the book of invitations? I don't think one person in 1,000 would be able to give you the answer.
No.
Two subjects. Yahweh is speaking to his people from the top of Mount Horeb, and he says, I'm going to explain for you all the symbols of the tabernacle. I want you to know what these things represent. And then the second half of the 25th, of the 24th chapter, is Yahweh saying, now for the really sensitive issue. I want you to make no mistake here. My name is really important. If you negate the value of my name, if you engage in blasphemy, which is the negation, the perforation, the tearing down on a part of my name, it's going to be really, really bleak for you. That's the unforgivable territory. So the second half of the 24th chapter, after the 23rd, is Yahweh's invitation to meet with them. The 24th chapter is here's the symbols in the tabernacle, and here's the instruction of my name. That's followed by the 25th chapter of Kara. Now it's a really important one, and my guess is you all know what's in the 25th chapter. It's the Yobel. Yahweh goes through the Yobel. lays out his economic plan and his plan of salvation. Seven times seven plus one. Exactly what we would see in going from Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim to Shavuah. Seven plus times seven plus one. In fact, Shavuah is the annual celebration of the bicentennial celebration of the twice a century celebration, every 50 years, I should say, of the Yovel, where all debt is forgiven, all slaves are freed, and the land is returned to its original owner, which would be Yahweh. That's the Yovel. So the 26th chapter of Korah is the Sermon on the Mount. Yahweh's Sermon on the Mount. Then Yahweh begins and says, here's what I'm offering. And if you concur with this, if you accept the terms and conditions of the covenant, these are the blessings. I mean, everything you can imagine in the now and the later is yours. You're going to be my kids, and I'm going to bless you with every possible blessing. But if you don't, if you negate, reject, ignore my testimony and my covenant, this is what's going to happen to you. You're going to be a blight on society. You're going to be bludgeoned. It's going to be terrorized. You're going to experience the Holocaust. All of these horrible things are going to happen to you. And it's Yahweh's Sermon on the Mount. Yeah, most people don't even know it's there. And when we reach the time of Jacob's troubles, like in Zephaniah, Yahweh was saying, I told you. I told you that this was going to happen. This was your choice. You could have everything that you could possibly imagine. You could be adopted into my family, be my kids, protected, enriched, enlightened, empowered. Or you could squander it all. It's your choice. Yahweh's Sermon on the Mount. Now, God's prophetic warning regarding Moab, as I said, isn't just in Yahshua Isaiah in the two chapters. It is also in Jeremiah. It's in Zephaniah. It's in Amos. It's in Ezekiel. It's in Daniel. All of these written long after Moab ceased to exist as a nation. But, oh, do we know so much about them? And I don't think there's one person in a thousand that knows what group of people Yahweh equated Moab to. He said, Moab is blank. You know who that was? He said, Moab is blank, which was Lot's eldest son through his eldest daughter. And then he said, Ammon, which is the people descended from Ben-Ami, his youngest son through his youngest daughter. He said, Moab equals, Ammon equals, and they will share their fate. What do you think the answer is?
Sodom and Gomorrah.
You got it.
Yeah.
Moab equals Sodom. And we know a lot about Sodom. And Ammon equals Amora. Amora means tyrannical dictators, oppressive authoritarian regimes. The world of Islam. And so we know exactly what God's talking about. And what does he say about the world today? That he's going to do to the world today what he did to Sodom and Gomorrah because the circumstances that necessitated the removal of those that disease, that blight on his land, required their destruction for his people to live safely. He'll do exactly the same thing. And so it's really important to understand what Moab represents so that as a reader of this material, you're not one of those who is dealt with as was the condition at Moab. Now, we're left with a single viable option as to who really Moab is. The lone reason that much of the attention is being focused on what was essentially a meaningless, long extent fiefdom is that Moab is indicative of something God finds appalling and pervasive today. After all, if not for the trade routes through the mountain passes connecting Egypt with Mesopotamia, Syria and Anatolia, and their capricious interactions with Israel 2,800 to 3,000 years ago, the people living in the ancient kingdom would not have left more than a footprint or two in all of history. In this regard, the Moabites are similar to the Philistines, in that these now extinct people are being used to depict future allegiances, many of them reprehensible. And that's not completely fair to the Moabites. Do you know how many written records that we have discovered from the so-called, we're actually Philistines, but the Palestinians, of course, if you serve their name. How many written records have we found, ancient stone, stela, tablets, written records that we found in totality now from the Philistines?
Zero. Nothing.
Zero. And why is it that we will never find one?
Because they didn't write any. They didn't do anything.
They didn't have a written language.
They were incredibly primitive.
Yep. Now, we find reference to Moab in an Egyptian hieroglyph. People called Moab. And it just says, you know, they were hacked and destroyed en route to some other thing. They were an ag, you know. But a quick mention. We do find a mention of them. We find a mention of them in some of the documentation in Assyria. The same kind of thing. They were collateral damage.
Yeah.
But we have something from Moab that we don't have from the Philistines. It's actually the Moabite stone. King Mishnah is the dude. He is the one that is the story of Moab's demise. He is a guy that murdered 10,000, brags about it, murdered 10,000 of his own people as human sacrifices to appease his god Chemosh and Baal Peor, including his own son, as human sacrifices. And we have his words written in his language using guess which alphabet?
Hebrew alphabet.
Hebrew. And guess who he mentions? Yahweh.
Moab.
And House of Tod. Moab. His name is exactly the way that Yahweh has it in the Torah prophets and so on. Every detail of Yahweh's account that dates to 850 BCE is affirmed on the stone that was only found 50 years ago. I've said over and over again that when you limit prophecy, which Yahweh does not, to predicting future events, you toss out a huge swath of the affirmation that the Torah prophets and Psalms are true. Prophecy from God's point of view is like his language. It isn't just about the future. It's about the present and the past. And for a document written 3,400 years ago to correctly describe the king, his mannerisms, his behavior, the interactions with him, their religion, and then find an affirmation written in stone that was written 2,850 years ago, collaborating all of it from the perspective of the king of Moab. Astonishing. And there isn't any other historical text that does that. I mean, the Roman historical texts were all propaganda. The Greek exaggerating their prowess or their ridiculous religious beliefs. It's the only document, only ancient document that accurately depicts ancient history and is precisely accurate. It's stunning that people don't consider it, and the scholars reject it. Stunning. Shows our arrogance. So God finds something truly appalling about Moab, which is still extant today. After all, you know, there is nothing of them left. Now, our quest to identify the essence of Moab today, it is indeed telling that it was on Mount Nebo in Moab. What happened on Mount Nebo in Moab?
Moshe.
Ever heard about Mount Nebo in Moab?
Yes, sir.
What happened there? That is correct.
Moshe was, yeah.
Voice of the Torah, right?
Mm-hmm. Voice of the Torah died.
Now, do you think there's a reason that we were told that Moshe died in Moab?
I think so.
Yeah.
So maybe, shouldn't we look for something in Moab pertaining to the voice of the Torah dying?
Mm-hmm.
What's the individual and what are the texts most responsible for silencing the voice of the Torah?
Paul.
Paul, of course.
Yeah, Paul's letters. So based upon that clue, boy, we've got a bunch of fingers pointed right at Pauline Christianity, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yahweh is really an extraordinary storyteller. And every little nuance, every detail, if you know how to make the right connections, will reveal an important truth. Now, the man given the great distinction for revealing Yahweh's Torah guidance to humankind, the man given the opportunity to liberate Yahweh's family from the crucible of religious, political, economic, and military oppression in Mizraim, the man chosen to lead God's children to the promised land, the long voice of Devarim, Deuteronomy, and the most often cited by Yosha, was only allowed to look into Yisrael from the vantage point of Moab, but not allowed to enter. This temporal restriction was the consequence of something that had happened 40 years earlier. What did Moshe do that caused him to be excluded from entering the promised land?
He struck the rock twice.
That's right. Yahweh said, speak to it, and he struck it. That doesn't sound like much, does it? Yahweh said, I want you to speak to the rock, and Moshe struck it. Not much of a difference. But that was enough for Yahweh to say, I want to make a point here. The point is, I know what I'm talking about. I want to give you the opportunity to twist and pervert my testimony, but not permission. I'm going to tell you when you do it, there's a consequence. It's what Satan did when he slithered into the garden and deceived Yahweh.
Pick him out too.
He twisted Yahweh's testimony. And here's Moshe. And Moshe is one of the coolest dudes in the history of cool dudes. And he did so many things extraordinarily right. And, you know, he's got a front row seat up there in heaven with Yah. But Yah wanted us to know that we don't have his permission. Even Moshe didn't have his permission to twist or pervert or to change his instructions. It's God's instruction. If we want to benefit from them, if we want him to quench our thirst, we don't have liberty to impose our own ideas on it. It's God's method to quench our thirst. That's what Moshe did. Do you know of any religions that had a propensity to replace Yahweh's testimony with their own?
All of them?
All of them?
No. I can come up with
Hour of the birth.
The first one, that's what it is at its essence. Islam, certainly. Rabbinic Judaism, Talmud over the Torah. How about Joseph Smith with his Book of Mormon?
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they're all that way. They have all chosen to do in a vastly more extensive way what Moshe did. And so Moshe, the lesson that Yahweh was teaching with this small thing with Moshe was designed to highlight the egregious mistake that has been perpetrated by Christians, Muslims, and religious Jews. Moab is quite simply and profoundly where we are confronted with the consequence of changing God's word. It is therefore reminiscent and in fact prophetic of the place where the Torah would be discarded and its message muted. The Pauline epistles of the Christian New Testament, the Talmud of Judaism, the Quran of Islam. So should Yahweh speak particularly of Shaul, which is where this happened to the greatest extent, the father of Christianity, in the midst of this expose on Moab, we will have all the affirmation we need to realize that Moab serves as a metaphor for the place that Yahweh's Torah and guidance was disregarded and his voice was silenced through Pauline Christianity. And I want you just to think for a moment. Moab wrote and spoke Hebrew. And yet they used the Hebrew terminology to promote the Baal Peor, the Lord of the broad and open way, the Christian God. They used Hebrew to promote Chemosh's God. They used Hebrew to justify human sacrifice. They twisted the Hebrew language, bastardized it for that purpose. You know that Arabic is a bastardized version of Hebrew.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The Christian New Testament bastardizes Hebrew by rendering it in Greek and then in Latin. It is out of a twisting of the Hebrew text that Moab became the symbol of what God despises today. And we have three religions that have all perverted and grown out of the Hebrew text: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It's yet another detail that we ought not miss.
So why did everybody miss it and you found it?
You know, read it. The thing we're going to find, Kirk. Yeah, it's...
Well, I cut you on the back, but it's the same time. What's wrong with these people?
Yeah, I have a friend that is not just fact-checking what I'm writing, but helping me kind of to see even broader pictures than I have previously seen. And so when I'm talking about what the obvious insights that Yahweh himself is providing about Moab. You know, it's just like the story of Sodom. It has nothing to do with sex. And yet, there is nobody that has written about Sodom for anything other than sex in probably the last 2,000 years.
True.
And so you'd say, so why are you able to see these things and no one else has seen them for 2,000 years? It's a legitimate question. I think the answer is awesomely simple. What do you think? I'm able to see these things that no one else has for 2,000 years.
Took the time.
Yeah. I went in with an open mind, with a desire to learn, and I invested the time. And rather than rely on a rabbinic argument or an Islamic argument or a Christian argument, I went to the source and said, what can I learn if I just consider the one individual that wrote about this from the beginning and communicated these stories for us to learn from them? What if you just go to him and just look at what he said and then think about it and make the connections to other things he said? What if you just do that? And it all bubbles up.
What a concept, eh?
Yeah, what a concept. So the answer is nothing. I didn't do anything that would have, it would impress anybody other than I was willing to devote the time. I've spent a lot of time in this chair looking at the words. And I even found something that was, I guess I really didn't appreciate. I have a lot of people that I've recommended a tool. It's called Q Bible. We call it Q Torah, but it's called Q Bible Online. It was actually a tool for Jews studying the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. That's why it was conceived. And it has this presentation that has three columns. Hebrew written in Hebrew, a transliteration of the Hebrew, and then an interlinear with links to Strong's and the DBO. And when I was rewriting this chapter in Moab, I turned to it because I can translate a passage using that tool 10 times faster than I can with Logos. And so I wrote many of these explanation chapters while I had translated the Yeshayahs 15 and 16 using Logos, and were amplified in detail form. I said, I'm just now trying to explain what Moab is. I don't need to get to that level of detail. Let's just get the message out quickly. Had to go back and start all over. There's just not the depth, the accuracy. And it was when I went back and said, you know, I'm going to do this the right way. This is just too much. We're losing here. And invested the time to translate every passage thoroughly. And it was just, I'm blown away on how many profound insights there is in things that no one would ever even consider. You know, I was confronted today on the radio interview, and they said that, you know, how would you deal with people who just say that, you know, the Old Testament is just hateful? And so, you know, why deal with a book that's that hateful? And I said, it is hateful. But I won't deny that at all.
I know 48.
Yeah. But what you don't have an appreciation of is that to love, you have to hate. And that Yahweh's presentation of hate is absolutely appropriate. And it's required if you're going to love. Well, I'm going to tell you that I hate pedophilia and pedophiles. I hate murder and mass murderers. I hate rape and rapists. And I despise those who would deliberately harm my family. And we all ought to. And so Yahweh, as a loving father, presents his plan to enrich and empower and uplift his children. And he also exposes and condemns the threats to them. And yet, we live in a world where we're indoctrinated by political correctness to say if we only would love and stamp out hate, the world would be great. No. If we did that, there'd be no justice. There'd be no mercy. Forces of evil would triumph. And so I found the expression of that as in these stories, which I just thought were historical accounts. I mean, we're dealing with first and second Malachim kings. And while these chapters, we will get into stories from other prophets, and they are profound. Do you really think you're going to find unique and powerful insights into establishing a relationship with Yah from Malachim kings? If you look at the, I made a mistake, maybe it's two shows ago, and I said, you know, the kings of Israel and Judah, for the most part, were rotten to the core, and the women were worse. That's not true. And so I want to apologize for making that statement. There were two women in the history of And the answers are found in the detail. And you don't find the detail without investing the time. Now, Kirk, your eyes have not only failed you these last couple of weeks, but will fail you for the next few weeks. And there's no way for you to read and do your normal study under this basis. I appreciate you even, you know, being with us this this evening and last week under these circumstances. I mean, it's a tremendous sacrifice, particularly with your wife also being sick. But normally, when your eyes are working, and, you know, they're going to work again great here in a month or so, you've gone even beyond the words right down to the letters. In fact, you even opened tonight, said you did some research on the fathers of the seven most popular religions in the world today. Because Moab means, who's your father? Who's your daddy? And so it's when you invest the time, which you are prone to do, you do marvelously. The insights enrich us all.
They turn to pop out if you look at them.
Yeah, if you look for them, they're there.
Anybody can do it. Yeah.
Anybody can do it. You and I can do it. JB is a whiz. He was corrupted by Christianity coming into this, so he didn't have to spend so much time disavowing all the stuff that we were led to believe that turned out to be false. But in particular, I come with all sorts of hang-ups that would normally cause a person to be horrible at this. I mean, you know, I was...
Hello?